Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, November 9th. We'll begin today with issues raised in the trials of Kyle Rittenhouse in Wisconsin and the three men accused of murdering Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. The cases are very different in some ways, but also have some major overlapping issues, including that they are both cases of alleged white vigilantes who killed people in racially charged circumstances as they assume the role of police officers, which they are not. In both cases, the defendants are pleading self-defense. And in both cases, there have been issues of racism on the jury. One juror in the Rittenhouse case has already been dismissed for telling a racist joke about the case to a court deputy who he apparently thought would find the racist joke funny and acceptable and not report him to the judge. And maybe the most publicized of all the issues so far is the infuriating finding by the judge in the Georgia case that there was intentional racism, intentional discrimination in the jury selection process, that racism did determine the composition of the jury, but there is nothing he can do about it. Here are a few clips of the judge, Timothy Walmsley, from the bench. First, the basic finding.
This court has found that there appears to be intentional discrimination in the panel. That's that prima facie case.
A prima facie case. Prima facie means clearly true, self-evident. Here the judge explains a little bit of why, but says he cannot reseat the jury.
Quite a few African-American jurors were excused through peremptory strikes exercised by the defense. But that doesn't mean that the court has the authority to reseat.
He doesn't have the authority to reseat, to order a new, not obviously racist jury selection process. And here he explains a little bit of why he believes he does not have that authority under Georgia state law.
Again, in the state of Georgia, all the defense needs to do is provide that legitimate, non-discriminatory, clear, reasonably specific, and related reason. And the court is not going to place upon the defendants a finding that they are being disingenuous to the court or otherwise are not being truthful with the court when it comes to their reasons for striking these jurors. So because of that, and because of, again, the limitations I think Batson places upon this court's analysis, I'm denying the motion.
A motion to do something that he wasn't going to do. Judge Timothy Walmsley, in the case of Gregory McMichael, Travis McMichael, they are father and son, 64 and 34 years old, respectively, and William Bryan, who in their cars chased the unarmed Arbery as he was out for a run with no evidence or any report that he committed any crime, then killed him after they caught up with him, tried to capture him for what they're calling a citizen's arrest, and Arbery apparently tried to defend himself from being abducted. With me now, Eli Mistal, justice correspondent for The Nation. Some of you will also remember he was the legal editor for Radiolab's Supreme Court series called More Perfect a few years ago. He also has a book coming out in January called Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitutional Hardcover. Eli, thanks for coming on today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Sorry, I had a with my dog. How are you doing?
Pick up your dog. Yes, pick up your dog. You got to pick up your dog. You got to take care of the dog first. I get it. So let's start with the clips that we played. And can you explain to the listeners how Georgia law can allow the defense to get away with a prima facie case of intentional racial discrimination in jury selection? And do you agree with the judge that he really had no power to reverse it?
No, of course not. Walmsley is that was a cowardly decision by Walmsley right there. He does, in fact, have power to reseat the jury. And we know he has that power because the prosecution made a motion for him to use that power that was in his discretion. He declined to use the power. This goes back to a case called Batson. You just brought up More Perfect, right? More Perfect has a beautiful episode on Batson challenges. It's called Object Anyway. The core of the Supreme Court case is that in 1980, which, just for your listeners, remember, was not that long ago, right? Mm. But in the 1980s, there was a Supreme Court case that finally, for the first time in American history, made it really illegal to exclude jurors just because of their race, right? So, like, Thriller was out before we could actually had a real good Supreme Court case on this issue, but fine. We have this case, and it says that you cannot exclude jurors because of their race. However, when you are challenged that you are excluding somebody for their race, the attorney who does the challenge, who says, you know, I don't want that juror, has to give a legitimate, non-racial, you know, race-neutral reason for excluding that juror. This is what happened in the McDaniel trial, right? They excluded a bunch of black jurors. The defense attorney gave race-neutral reasons for excluding those black jurors, and then they brought it to a judge. The judge is under the impression that he has to accept the defense, in this case, the defense attorney's reasons, non-racial reasons, for excluding the jurors. The judge is acting like he cannot say, but I see what you did there. In fact, he could have said, but I see what you did there. He could have said, well, not only is there prima facie evidence that, you know, this jury was racially biased, but the specific reasons that you've given to exclude these specific black jurors are, in fact, not reasons that I believe. He could have said that. He declined to say that. Now, he is right. This does go back to a fundamental weakness in Batson, a weakness that Justice Thurgood Marshall pointed out in the Batson case. While he was concurring with the opinion, Marshall said, unfortunately, while this opinion is absolutely necessary, unfortunately, Marshall did not think it would solve the problem because he understood that defense attorneys would give these race-neutral reasons and judges, people like Wansley, would believe them when they don't have to. And that's the whole problem here. Like, you have a defense attorney making kind of, again, allegedly race-neutral but obviously disingenuous reasons. You have a judge accepting those obviously disingenuous reasons and going forward with a nearly all-white jury. There's one black juror on that jury in a county that is 26% black. It's a weakness of our system, but sometimes when people say, like, oh, it's the system's fault, like, let's not forget that there are people making decisions that are also weak, right? Wansley, weak. The defense attorneys. Brian, the defense attorneys said during voir dire, which is when you question the jury, that what they needed was to get some more bubbas on the jury. And then they defined bubbas as white men over 40 with no college education.
Wow.
Now, tell me, you know, people sometimes accuse me of accusing racism without evidence. If you don't think that that's racist, tell me why the defense attorney, the professional defense attorney, thinks that non-college educated white men over 40 are better for his clients who have been accused of a lynching. Tell me why that's going to help them. Because the defense attorney certainly thinks it's going to help them. And you know what? I think it's going to help them too. And you know what? The judge thinks it's going to help them too. But of the people I just mentioned, the judge is the person who had the power to stop this and decided not to.
Would there be a way for jury selection laws to be written or for another Supreme Court case to come down with different guidelines than Batson to prevent that?
Well, there are two things. As I speak about in my upcoming book, Allow Me to Retort, out January 11th.
By the way, consider this a public book interview for when it comes out. So go ahead. invitation. Book interview invitation. So come on back next month. But go ahead.
I wrote about this. So there are two things that we could do here. One, we could do what Marshall suggested, which was to get rid of peremptory challenges, whole stop, right? The whole point of a peremptory challenge is that you've got this whole jury. It's called the veneer. So everybody who answered the jury summons is in this room. And the defense or the prosecution, the lawyers ask them questions. And then for any reason or no reason at all, they can be like, no, don't want you on my jury. Goodbye. Right? Now, Batson says the any reason or no reason at all cannot be because they're black. Right? But because we know that attorneys can get around this rule, Marshall's suggestion was to take away peremptory challenges completely. A case trying to do that actually also went all the way up to the Supreme Court in like the early 90s, I believe, and Marshall lost 5-4. It was actually one of Marshall's last cases. He dissented from that opinion. It was one of his last acts on the court. So that would have been one way, to just get rid of peremptory challenges entirely. Another way is to really kind of think about what the Sixth Amendment means when it says that you are entitled to a jury of your peers. So the late Antonin Scalia, who I can spend easily the rest of my life arguing against, he has said that that means that you are entitled to a fair veneer. That means all the people who answer the summons. So if I send out the summons to only white people, then that, according to Scalia, would be violative of the Sixth Amendment, which makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. But he says that the Sixth Amendment doesn't give you the right to a fair petite jury, which is what people actually think of as the actual jury, like the 12 people sitting in the box, right? Mm-hmm. He says the Sixth Amendment doesn't entitle you to fairness there, which is a bonkers distinction, right? He's saying that you can have a fair cross-section of the community when they answer the summons, but you're not entitled to a fair cross-section of the community when they get into the box. That's ridiculous. I think that case is wrong. I think Scalia is wrong. And if we just apply the same Sixth Amendment protections that we have when we ask people to answer a jury summons, when it's time for them to get into the box, that would solve it, right? So if the county is 26% black, as Brunswick, Georgia is, then the jury should be, you know, somewhere around that, 1 in 5, you know, of the jurors should be people of color. Mm-hmm. That you could just make that the rule then, right? That the actual jury has to represent the community, the diversity of the community, just like the veneer, just like the people who answer the summons jury.
We've been talking about jury selection so far, and of course there are other issues in these cases. The central one, I guess, is that, and to stay with the murder of Arbery case for a minute, they're claiming self-defense in the process of making a citizen's arrest. When would three non-police officers be allowed to make a citizen's arrest, basically abducting and imprisoning another private citizen who hasn't been charged with anything?
Yeah, no, that's a term, citizen's arrest, I think that people got from like watching too much Batman as a kid. that's called kidnapping, is what they were trying to do. And they shot him instead. Look, for the self-defense claims, both of the cases, and this is maybe a way that we can transition, right? Both the McDaniels case, which is the name of two of the three people who were accused of lynching Arbery, and the Rittenhouse case, both of these self-defense claims require you to basically start the clock right before they fire their guns, right? So you can, if you only look at the situation, what they're both asking you to do is to only look at the situation kind of the second or two before they fire. Now, in the McDaniel case, even that doesn't help them at all. But that's what they want you to do, to look at the 2 seconds before, as opposed to the entire encounter, the entire altercation, who started it, who caused it. They don't want you to look even 1 minute before they fire the gun, a minute and a half, 90 seconds. That's too long. Don't think of it that way. And that's what both of these defendants are asking you to do, which, again, you don't have to. You don't have to be like, well, it's self-defense because in the exact moment right before I fired that shot, I can make this claim. You're allowed to look 5 seconds before, 10 seconds before, 15 seconds before. You're allowed to look at their state of mind when they got themselves into the altercation in the first place, to weigh the sincerity of their self-defense claims and intent. That's how I would look at it if I was on the jury, but right. I'm not.
And in this case, this is how the two cases might be kind of different, but you'll give me your take. But in the McMaster case, if they chased and then stopped Arbery, who was simply running on the road, tried to forcibly abduct him, they started it. I don't even think that's in dispute. And then Arbery does something to resist being abducted, which could be physically threatening to the kidnappers, and they defend themselves. And you're talking about where the clock starts in that whole sequence. Is that self-defense under the law?
No, because for a couple of reasons. First of all, resisting being kidnapped is not a violent threat with deadly force. Arbery was unarmed. There's no indication they did anything to. I mean, everybody's seen the video. There's no indication they did anything to become. You know, it's not like he pulled a gun out of. You know, turned his fist into a stabbing weapon like he's the Terminator 2000, right? Like there's nothing there. So for them to respond with deadly force for a non-deadly altercation, I think throws their self-defense claim just completely out of the window. I don't see how you get there. Really, the only way to make the self-defense claim is if you believe, as these, I believe, racist white people did seem to believe, that black people are inherently dangerous and should be put down in the street. If you believe that, then I guess you can make this self-defense claim, right? If you're defending, you know, a white ethnostate, I guess you can make that claim. But if you're doing anything kind of along the normal thinking and course of the law, there is no self-defense claim here.
I'm haunted,
this was
though,
just a lynching.
By the specter of the Trayvon Martin case in 2013, which I think really launched the modern Black Lives Matter movement. Martin was walking through a neighborhood, people may remember, no evidence he committed a crime. A local self-appointed resident watchdog, George Zimmerman, not a police officer, went out to accost him. Martin defended himself, and in the altercation, Zimmerman killed him. Zimmerman was acquitted in that case on the grounds of self-defense, if I remember correctly. Legally speaking, how much is this like that?
It's exactly like that. And you're right to point out that in Zimmerman in Florida, he walked. And I believe that because people like Zimmerman walked, it made these people like McDaniels feel even more empowered and emboldened to go out and do what they did. And I also think that the Zimmerman case is one of the reasons why Kyle Rittenhouse felt empowered and emboldened to go out and do what he did. And if McDaniels and Rittenhouse both walk, then more people will create another generation of white people who feel emboldened to go out to the streets and find black people to shoot and kill. Like there's no mystery here in terms of what's happening. There's no real mystery here in terms of why it's happening. The only mystery is whether 11 white people in a jury in Georgia will finally say no this far and no further. This is the line. That's the only mystery. And, you know, we'll see.
So now let's transition to the Rittenhouse case in Wisconsin, also a self-defense claim, but arguably more complicated. He killed two people. All his victims were white, by the way. He killed two people during that chaotic protest, but the third person he shot who survived testified in court yesterday that he was pointing his gun at Rittenhouse when Rittenhouse fired on him. But after Rittenhouse had killed the two other people, and the third victim perceiving that Rittenhouse was an active shooter, but Rittenhouse was having a gun pointed at him when he fired on that third person. So here is a clip from that testimony. The man who was shot is named Gage Grosskreutz. He's being questioned by Rittenhouse's defense attorney, Corey Cherifisi, who speaks first, showing a video and asking, does this look like your arm being shot?
Does this look like right now your arm is being shot?
That looks like my bicep being vaporized, yes.
Okay. And it's being vaporized as you're pointing your gun directly at him. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, so when you were standing 3 to 5 feet from him with your arms up in the air, he never fired, right?
Correct.
It wasn't until you pointed your gun at him, advanced on him, with your gun, now your hands down, pointed at him, that he fired, right?
Correct.
Ellie, self-defense?
Yeah, so that's a tougher case, at least as it pertains to Gage, right? Like Gage was armed and advancing upon Rittenhouse. Now, again, I would argue that there's a duty to retreat, that there are other things that Rittenhouse could have done in that situation other than try to kill the man. But I would have a tougher argument to make, right? Like you just experientially, people need to believe that if somebody is coming at you with a gun, that the right thing to do in that situation is to blow their brains out, right? But again, this is a question of starting the, where do you start the clock? The defense attorney wants to start the clock 10 seconds before Rittenhouse shot. They don't want to start the clock when Rittenhouse was seen earlier in the evening chasing those very people around the streets. They don't want to start the clock when Rittenhouse crosses state lines with an unlicensed gun to join the protests in the first place. They don't want to start the clock 2 weeks before it's 2 weeks before the protests in Kenosha, where Rittenhouse is on video watching people leave a CBS and saying to his friend on camera, "I wish I had a gun so I could go shoot those looters." They don't want to start the clock there in terms of Rittenhouse's overall state of mind and propensity to violence. They want to start the clock the 10 seconds before Rittenhouse shoots. And if you start the clock the 10 seconds before Rittenhouse shoots Gage, sure, you can make a color, unlike the Aubrey situation, you can make a colorable claim for self-defense there for the one guy that he shot but didn't kill. But there are two other people that he actually killed, which is where I think his self-defense claims start to fall apart.
One more thing, as we're running out of time, I just want to mention this and get your take on it. One of the defendant's vehicles in the McMaster case had a Confederate flag decal on it, and apparently that's been deemed admissible as evidence. Can you explain the context of that as evidence?
Well, evidence is state of mind, right? Look, in these cases, what the person's intent was in the moment is always important, right? And when you're rolling around your former Confederate state in your General Lee Confederate memorabilia vehicle, like, that kind of gives you an indication as to what their intent was while committing the crime. To say nothing of, it gives you an indication of Aubrey's state of mind, right? So if I'm jogging down the street and somebody in a Confederate flag car comes hauling after me, what am I going to do? Am I going to be like, oh, those are probably just concerned citizens, let me explain to them why I'm jogging through their lovely community? No! I'm going to run as fast as I can. Now, I'm very slow and fat, so I wouldn't get very far. But, you know, if I see a Confederate flag vehicle coming at me, I'm going to do everything I can in my power to get away. And so that's the other reason why that's admissible. That's important evidence in this crimes. It shows why Aubrey took the actions he took in the heat of the moment.
On issues in the Rittenhouse and McMaster cases, Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent for The Nation. Some of you will also remember he was the legal editor for Radiolab's Supreme Court series called More Perfect a few years ago. He also has a book coming out in January called Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitutional Hardcover. Ellie, please come back then.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian, and hope to see you soon.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.